Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, Everyday Innovators. I'm bringing back my guest from episode 17, which was about creating the ProdBoc, the guide to the product management and marketing body of knowledge, and how Greg Geraci led that effort. I also shared on that episode that he is the co-author of the annual study of product team performance, which recently became available this year. So I asked him back to share the key findings from that study and to help all of us better understand team performance and changes that could improve performance of product teams. Greg, thanks for coming back for another interview.
My pleasure, Chad. Thanks for having me.
This is a study I've enjoyed following, and I think I've caught it each year it's come out, and I believe you're in the fourth year now conducting the market research. I haven't actually looked at the new report because I was kind of eager to talk with you first about it and didn't want to, you know, ruin it. Give us a brief history of the study.
Yeah, that's right, Chad. We actually have been conducting the study since 2012, although with a different purpose. Our original assumption was actually quite different than the path that we've been on for the last 4 years. Originally, tell you sort of a funny story, we started looking at we wanted to look at the interrelationships between various functional areas and how to optimize them. The co-authors of the study all come from different areas. There's four of us. One is a CTO. The other heads a consulting company that focuses on project management. The other is a former chapter head for the Chicago IIBA. So all of us had various interest in trying to understand how to optimize working relationships between the functions. But what ended up happening was after we conducted the first study and we handed the data off to an independent statistician to conduct regression analysis, we actually ended up focusing in on something completely different than what we'd originally set out to do, and that is key factors that correlate with high performance on product teams. This was not something that we were looking for back in 2012 when we launched the study, but it's become really the core of our activities over the last 4 years. We conduct, as you mentioned, the survey annually. And if you go back to the original set of findings, our findings in 2012 showed that if a team had all five of these factors in place, they had a 67% chance of being high performance. And if those factors were not in place, only a 2% chance. So that's what sort of got our wheels started on this track. And we've continued to ask, a set of consistent questions, longitudinally, if you will, over the course of this 4 year period. And then we always blend in new questions around areas that we as consultants and people who are practitioners see in the marketplace that drive our interest. Part of the problem, of course, is it's really hard to find statistically significant data. And, our view is that product managers and product teams should thrive on data. So we've worked to try to round out the picture as much as we can by collecting as much statistically significant data as we can and then presenting it, in these white papers each year.
Very good. And just to give the everyday innovators that are listening a bit of an idea of high performance, I'd like to get your take on this. My experience with that is a high performing team is rare and special. And the research I've seen from my background in software development is high performing teams can be, 3x to 5x more productive. And recently I saw some teams using Scrum that were high performing on the order of 8x more productive than another team. So this means taking the same size group of people, right, that they're outperforming a regular team by, 5x or more. And that's a very special thing when that happens, right? You kind of have this code that happens, you're holding each other accountable and there's high trust. And it's a neat thing to be a part of a high-performing team. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I completely agree with you that being part of a high performance team is something you'll always remember. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. I mean, when you're on a high performing product team, you know it. There's no way around it. And, everyone looks to try to who's been on one of those kind of teams tries to replicate that experience time and time again.
That's right.
The formula for doing it's pretty complex. To date, we've identified over 20 statistically significant factors that correlate with high performance on product teams. And each one of our studies typically has turned up between 4 to 6 factors in any given year. We've even gone further. So to us, it doesn't necessarily correlate with the size of the team, although we could talk about that because we've done some research in that area. But for us, what we've been able to do through regression analysis is basically come up with a 10-point scale for these factors that correlate with high performance. And then each one of these factors has an individual weighting that we use in client engagements, with the survey instrument to basically identify where organizations are going to get the greatest return on investment to shore up these gaps in order to try to, move their teams towards high performance. So that's sort of the approach that we've taken, Chad.
Yeah, it makes sense. So you help them identify which factors really need to focus on to get more performance from them. Before we dive into those factors some, let's get a little more context. Who are the survey participants that answer the questions?
That's a great question. Well, basically, on any given year since 2012, we've had between 1,100 to 1,400 different survey respondents. Not all the respondents are the same year over year, but we do keep a running database that we send invitations to participate in the survey out to. So there is a certain subset of the pool that remains consistent year over year. The groups that we're after, because we're looking at high performance teams, are those team members who make up core product teams. So those would be product managers and product owners, project and program managers, engineers and development managers, UX professionals and QA, business analysts, and product marketers. So it's really the core people who are actively involved in, product development activities. In fact, survey participants, 92% of them tell us that they're actively involved in product development on any given year, somewhere between 92% and 94%. So these are the people actually doing the work, or at least doing the work or overseeing those teams. To give you a sample on the 2015 study, we had about 22% of the mix were product managers and product owners. Mm-hmm. Normally that number is a little higher, but we had really strong participation from the project and program manager group this year. In fact, for the first time ever, they actually eclipsed product management. We had 34% of the survey respondents from the project and program management community. This is attributed to the fact that one of our sponsors is really focused on this space, and that's Project Connections. So they were able to bring a lot of project and program managers who hadn't participated in the past in the fold. Mm-hmm. The third largest group was engineers and development managers, making up about 17%. And then the rest sort of tumbled into the various categories. So, really strong participation from product, project, and, engineering and development managers. We know a little bit more about them because we do ask some demographics questions of all of our survey respondents. And one of the other things I can tell you is that the largest response category in terms of where survey respondents reported into was actually into managers. Roughly about 31% of survey respondents reported into a manager. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, about 60% of the survey respondents report into either a company officer, a VP, or director. So there's a lot of executive
involved. Yeah, a lot of high-end. Yep.
Yeah, which is great because, some of the study's findings can't be solved at the team member level. So having that level of visibility with executives who influence and can provide resources for some of these, decisions that have to be made in terms of organizational structure or process selection and adoption, things like that is really important. From a vertical standpoint, about 42% of the survey respondents come from either hardware or software, so technology. 24% come from service organizations, and 12% come from consumer products, and the rest basically come from government and education. And then finally, when it comes down to annual revenues, about one-third have less than $50 million in annual revenues, 40%, the bulk, if you will, have $50 million to $2 billion, and then 27% are really large organizations, over $2 billion in annual revenues.
Okay, so a nice mix. I was going to ask you about the companies that participated. So you're across the size of organizations also.
Yeah, you know, the reason why we ask the demographic questions beyond wanting to know a little bit about who these folks are, they allow us to do cross tabs that enable us to, you know, look at specific segments of the market.
Yeah, because it would be important to figure out if there were some factors that were dominant for controlling performance in large organizations that weren't present in small organizations.
Exactly.
Right? And so you can look across that. So, and I assume the factors we're going to talk about are the ones that apply to any product team, any size organization.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's first paint with some kind of broad strokes here. What is it that the product team members themselves are saying about their own performance?
It's really interesting, Chad, because we've noticed that there have been some changes over the years, and I'll get to that in a minute, mm-hmm. about how teams perceive their own performance. And we don't have the data to support our hypothesis. You know, we've been tracking the data, but we don't actually, you know, understand the key driver for it. But I'll share that with you in a minute. So what we found out this year was that 39% of product teams told us that they deliver value consistently on scope, schedule, and cost, which is the highest number that's ever responded favorably to that question since the inception of the survey. But 47% say that they deliver value, but they do so inconsistently. And then the rest of the survey respondents said they're either hit or miss, or we miss more than we hit. And that was roughly about 15%. So the bottom line is that, you know, about 39% of teams saying that they're consistent in their execution in terms of delivering value. And then, you know, 60% of teams are basically saying that, you know, they're less effective at being able to deliver value consistently. Some, though, are, you know, really struggling, about 13% or so.
And let me ask you real quick, Greg, when you say deliver value, is it in terms of delivering on that triple constraint of scope, schedule, and cost, or is there another aspect to that?
Yes. So, you know, historically, one of the key regression analysis factors that we use to determine performance was this question about, you know, do you deliver, you know, value consistently on scope, schedule, and cost? And while over the last couple of years, we've wanted to modify this question, because we've sort of now locked ourselves into 4 years of asking the same question, we don't want to invalidate sort of the trend data that we've been able to accumulate on this. So what we've done is we've now added financial questions and job satisfaction filters in addition to the value question that we utilize in the regression analysis to be able to sort out the high performers.
Okay. Yeah. And that's real important for listeners. You know, a lot of times when we do these sort of studies, it's the changes from 1 year to the next that really become what's important for us to focus upon. So being able to have a mechanism for tracking those changes is key to us.
Yep.
Okay.
Chad, can I just add on to it? Because I wanted to, one thing I did want to hit was sort of the trend that we've seen over the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, back in 2012, to give you a sense, so remember, this was in the heart of the Great Recession. It was the survey respondents who said that their teams were delivering value consistently on scope, schedule, and cost made up only 12% of the total responses. Wow. And it's gone up consistently year over year up to the 39% that we see today. So it moved through the 20s over the, you know, 2013 and 2014 and is now in the 30s in 2015. And what we believe is going on here has a lot to do with the fact that the recession is lifted, of course, that there has been a great reduction in layoffs and that hiring freezes have been left. So this, in our estimation, although, as I said earlier, we don't have the data to actually fully pinpoint this, we believe that there's a direct correlation between staffing levels and how teams are responding to this question.
Right. Makes sense. And just in conversations with companies, as I'm sure you're seeing too, there just seems to be that if there was an enthusiasm curve, it seems to be increasing, right? It seems to be people are getting more excited about product development than they may have been when the economy was rough.
Yeah, you know, the irony is I completely agree with you, but, you know, we also see that organizations are also more cautious about trying to find the right candidate. Mm. And so while they have more open positions, it seems like they're actually slower at filling them, even though the positions they have many more positions open.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good to know too. So let's move on talking about some of the specific methods that you saw identified in the study. When it comes to product development methods, what are organizations using? You know, like I mentioned Scrum just in passing earlier about high performance teams. What's showing up on your survey?
Yeah. So once again, this is another longitudinal kind of data point that we've been tracking for a few years. So let me share with you first the data from 2015, and then maybe we could talk a little bit about sort of what the pattern's been over the course of the last 4 years in terms of adoption rates. Does that make sense, Chad?
Sure.
Okay. So, you know, in 2015, what we saw is that blended methodologies, and for those in your audience who may be less familiar with blended, it's typically some combination of waterfall along with some agile approach combined together into what is then called a blended methodology. So it's not pure waterfall. It's not pure agile. It's a combination of the two. And so that the number one response for 2015 at 43% was blended methodologies. Following in second place was agile Scrum. We asked a question, I believe it was in our 2013 study, for survey respondents to basically tell us which methodology of Agile they were using. And it was like 95% of those who associated the term Agile were directly associating it with Scrum. Agile Scrum basically made up about 26% of survey responses this year, followed by Waterfall at almost 14%. And then Kanban was about 3.2% of responses. Interestingly, about 11% of survey respondents didn't know what methodology that they were using. And then about 4% were other, meaning something that's not listed here.
Right. Okay. And when it comes to the blended methodology, so they're using some sort of agile approach with that blended. So it sounds like the majority of organizations at least have taken a step towards the agile movement and applying that. Do you have any insights into what that blended methodology is like inside of companies? What I'm trying to get to, are they in the process of moving more towards agile, or is it because of the nature of work they do? Because maybe there's the integration problems they have, they still have a waterfall framework that they have agile pieces they plug into. Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of how that works out?
I do. Actually, that's a really astute question, Chad. So there's a variety of things that are going on that we think are constraints to full adoption of Agile. And when we talk a little bit more about sort of the overall trend, I think this will even become more tangible. But one of the reasons we know that organizations struggle is if you look back historically, you would see that waterfall back in, let's say, 2012 was about 18% of total responses. And organizations that had wanted to move from pure waterfall into Agile had tried to make the jump to Agile, but some of them actually weren't successful and actually fell into blended due to organizational constraints. So part of it was failed aspirations, you know, just the cultures of their organizations prohibited them from being able to do that successfully, or, maybe they didn't have the talent to do it, things along those lines. Another constraint can be processes. For example, you know, large organizations, for example, something the scale of like a Procter & Gamble or a GE or Johnson & Johnson, a lot of times they have capital requests that are annual kind of processes. And so while aspects of the development process may be Agile or Scrum, the organizational constraints mean that they have to plan out just to get the capital, mm-hmm. What they're going to do for the course of a year. So that inhibits their ability to be fully agile. And so they end up sort of falling into a blended kind of methodology. So those are some examples of the things that constrain organizations from successfully making the jump. But there are a range of other ones as well.
Okay. So let's build on this question of the methodology. And if you have an answer to this question, it could really help the everyday innovators listening. Do you have any data that associates the choice of product development method with a product's profitability?
In fact, we do. We've only been asking this question for the last 2 years, Chad. So what we've basically found is that Agile, you know, when you ask survey respondents, so the same people that answered what method they were using, what their thoughts are about how choice of product development method impacts a product's profitability, mm-hmm. you get a different picture than what they actually use. So let me lay this out. So when you ask them purely about profitability, not about the process they use, what they'll tell you is that Agile Scrum is the preferred methodology. When we asked the question this year, 36% of survey respondents indicated that Agile Scrum had the most favorable impact on product profitability, even though, remember, only 26% of teams in 2015 said they actually use Agile. So that there's a 10% differential between those who are using it and those who aspire to use it, if you will. When that 10% really comes a lot out of the blended area, because what you see there when you compare the two is, you know, blended methodologies when asked, or those who responded to this question about profitability and said blended, they made up only 32%. And if you go back to our conversation earlier, 43% of right. organizations said they were using blended. So there's that 10% differential, mm-hmm. which, you know, we've seen this, and by the way, this is a really interesting point. We've seen this differential in terms of 10 percentage points roughly between these two over the course of the last 2 years. So that to us indicates that there are trapped agilists who want to actually become agile that are trapped in blended land who want to make the jump but haven't been able to do so. So we think there's more upside actually for, you know, agile methodologies to take hold. And I want to circle back to the trend once we're done talking about profitability, because I think it'll shed some insight on that. Waterfall falls in half basically from what we had seen earlier. It was, I believe if I remember right, it was 13, almost 14%. Mm-hmm. And when asked about profitability, only 6% of survey respondents believe that waterfall is the most, has the most favorable impact on profitability. Kanban makes a big jump up to about 5% from, I believe it was about 3%, 3.2. And, a large section of people just answered they didn't know. About, you know, almost 20% said other or I don't know. So hands down, Agile Scrum wins when it comes down to a product's profitability, and it does so largely at blended's expense.
Okay. And I know it's in your study and in other studies, it's hard to tease out this actual topic of profitability, right? Because there's so many dimensions that go into that. And we're really focused on the product development aspect, making that more efficient is what it sounds like is the theme here, and using agile approaches to make that more efficient, as opposed to figuring out at the beginning how to develop the right product in the first place, right? Because that's part of this problem of profitability. Developing the right product certainly leads to a more profitable product. And I don't know if that dimension was in your study or not.
We did ask a question about innovation, but it was more about who leads innovation. So we didn't address the exact challenge that you've laid out, okay. Chad, but we do have some information about basically to cut to the nut of it. What we found in our study was that there's a leadership continuum that emerges by functional role in three phases inside of organizations, where, you know, in the early stages of a company's growth, obviously it's a C-level executive, usually the CEO, who plays the innovation leader role. But when you get above 50 million in annualized revenues up to 2 billion, what we saw in the data, reflected in the data, was that product managers were expected to play the innovation role. That doesn't mean they're always necessarily set up for failure. I mean, for success in that role. Sometimes they're set up for failure in doing that because they're being asked, you know, to stretch too thin, or they may not have the right skill set. Some product managers are better at incremental improvements than they are at, you know, exponential increases. And so, so the bottom line basically is, you know, that middle group from 50 million to 2 billion, there's an expectation by team members that product managers are going to carry that load, whether they're equipped to do so or not. And then finally, in the largest organizations, what showed up in the data was that cross-functional teams that were selected by the executives, so this is in the $2 billion and above companies, actually championed innovation at that point, as opposed to an individual such as a product manager. So while it doesn't answer the question that you asked, that is the finding around innovation that showed up in the data this year.
Okay. And you talked about the product manager being set up for success or failure. You know, product managers typically have this tension between wanting to be, you know, spend their time working on strategic activities and having to spend their time working on tactical activities and going back and forth. And some organizations split that role, which is helpful. But were there any other findings that from your study that directly impact product management and what product managers are doing?
Yeah. So there were a couple areas that we delved into that directly touched on product managers. One had to do with backlog ownership. The second had to do with time spent in the field. And the third had to do with accountability metrics, which was really interesting. So we definitely have to make sure we cover that on this conversation. But let me start with backlog ownership. We found that only 45% of survey respondents indicate that product managers or product owners are responsible for the backlog, which was sort of shocking. That's a good number, but it's less than 50%. And when you think about, you know, backlogs, you would think that a product owner or product manager would be the one running them. In fact, only 29% of survey respondents said the product manager and 16% said the product owner. Interestingly, though, 25% of organizations indicated that there was no single owner of the backlog in the survey responses and that the rest of the backlogs were being run by C-level executives, which we presume this has to do with startup organizations. So there's still an evolution, I think, taking place. I think, you know, particularly in small organizations, it's likely that somebody other than the product manager may be running the backlog. And then there's a certain subset of organizations where it's actually a team activity as opposed to a functional activity. Mm-hmm. And that showed up pretty clearly in the data.
Okay. And what about the accountability metrics?
Yeah, this one's really interesting. So we found a bit of a surprise there. It appears that customer satisfaction is the most commonly used metric to judge product management's performance. In fact, the next largest category was we don't hold our product managers accountable at 31% of responses, which was rather disturbing to us.
Well, it might be good news for some project managers that are a little bit unsure about what they're doing, I suppose. But we all want to feel like we have a good sense of accomplishment and know how that's being measured, right? And right. That's a little bit surprising, too.
Well, and Chad, on top of that, if I could just, you know, one thing. The interesting thing was financial metrics such as top line revenue, profit, market share, or mm-hmm. even velocity were all in the low 20s as it relates to percentages. So, you know, customer satisfaction, if there had to be a universal, and we did a crosstab across all the various verticals, technology, consumer products, et cetera, customer satisfaction was the universal metric for accountability for product managers, and followed then by, you know, we don't hold our product managers accountable. I do have a theory about what's going on here, though.
Please share.
Okay. So my guess is, first of all, a couple of years back, we asked a question about how many product managers had P&Ls. And as it turned out, only 19% of product managers said that they actually had a P&L. And those were disproportionately skewed towards consumer products type kind of companies as opposed to technology companies where it's much rarer for product managers to have a P&L. The theory that I have here is because there are no good mechanisms in place to enable product managers to be able to track these metrics very effectively and proactively, you know, intercede, if you will. I think we've sort of defaulted to this position of, you know, customer satisfaction measurement. And then, you know, that small low tier of 20% of organizations that actually have some type of device in place that enables product managers to actually be tracked for top line revenue, for profitability, for market share or velocity. And so I think, to be quite honest, I think this is a reflection on the way that organizations have constructed accountability or lack thereof mm-hmm. inside their organizations by not putting the mechanisms in place that enable product managers to actually be successful from a metrics and accountability standpoint. You often hear people saying, hey, you know, we want our product managers to be the CEOs of the company, you know, like of their product.
Of their product, yep.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, they don't give them the necessary, you know, tools to actually successfully do that.
Right. And I would think, you know, some people listening probably are in organizations where the organization roles are very different, right? And there could be a product owner, which goes by many different names, that holds maybe those financial responsibilities in the P&L, and the product manager just doesn't see that, right? And so
that's
this
right.
does vary a lot by organization too. I am glad to hear the customer satisfaction at least made the list. In this case, was at the top of the list, because we have, you know, we've gone through this quality change where at one time, any kind of project that was developing a product, quality was often in terms of, did we meet the requirements? And requirements tend to be kind of nebulous at the end, to more of a fitness for use. Did we satisfy the user? You know, is the customer happy with the product? Which I think is moving in the right direction, that we're developing things that actually bring value to customers and satisfies them.
Well, and the other thing is two things. I think Apple, you know, obviously had a lot to do with changing every customer's expectation of what a product is and what it does. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is a lot of mid-sized to large organizations track customer satisfaction with survey instruments and things along those lines. So to me, I think this has become the number one metric. One, because it's meaningful, but two, because there are ways that organizations are actually constructed today with tool sets that enable them to be able to look at these numbers
sure.
you know, over time.
Yeah, and things like the Net Promoter Score, NPS, that you know help us have some gauge of do customers refer you to other customers, certainly are used a lot in organizations. Okay, so let's move on to another topic. And this is a juicy one I'm eager to hear more about, because I understand from a previous conversation with you that your regression analysis turned up four new factors that correlate with high performance and product teams. And to put that in non-stat speak, that you found some new factors that may influence high performance. And what are those factors?
Okay, so there are four factors, as you mentioned. The first one has to do with strategic decision making. Our data showed this year that only 37% of organizations indicated that they are good at making and sticking with strategy. And what that means basically is that product teams that develop this aptitude are more likely to be high performing. That's what showed up in the regression analysis. Mm-hmm. And it's clear from the data that there's a real tactical bias within most organizations, and companies could better differentiate themselves more effectively by putting more weight on cultivating these strategic skills and staying the course with only incremental changes barring major market movements. But only 37% of organizations say that they actually are effective at being able to do this. So those organizations that actually have this skill to not only make the decisions, but to stick with the strategy and recognize that, you know, it'll incrementally change over time, outperform their peers.
Okay.
The second one, and this gets to the tactical side of things, is stand-up frequency. It turns out that teams that regularly hold stand-ups, which was 40% of the survey respondents, are more likely to be high performing. Teams that held daily or regular stand-ups stood out in the data, and stand-up frequency is highly correlated to high performance. In fact, those teams that held stand-ups daily were more likely to overachieve all the other responses to the, you know, as it relates to, you know, the relative amount of options. They would outperform their counterparts significantly, followed by those who do it regularly. So, you know, the more frequent that stand-ups are held, the more likely a team is to actually be high performing.
And just for anyone listening not familiar with the concept of stand-up, this is a Scrum practice and in other disciplines too, of having the group come together, physically standing up for the meeting because it's intended to be short, 15 minutes or so, right? And dealing with the issues that are current, working those cross-functionally, and making sure work is being accomplished each day.
Yep. And, you know, we have seen in previous studies that one of the major breakdowns was communications and handoffs mm-hmm. between the various functions. And obviously having some kind of discipline in this capacity, which enables, you know, that cross-functional communication and to sort of surface these issues before they fester, obviously has an impact on reducing those kind of problems.
Very good. Okay. What was the third factor?
The third one had to do with quick problem recovery. It turns out that product teams that quickly rally past unforeseen issues in the product development process are more likely to be high performing. However, we found that 67% of organizations struggle in this area, and most, and it was just shy of 50%, citing a low ability to respond to these type of issues. So nimble teams that are able to quickly adapt to, you know, unforeseen issues are highly correlated to higher performance. Teams that, you know, struggle with these issues tend to be, you know, more correlated with lower levels of performance as well.
Okay. So again, the nimble team, the team that is flexible and can be agile and recover quickly.
Yep. Okay. And then finally, the fourth factor this year was UX collaboration with product management. In fact, the data showed that active involvement of UX professionals in the product development process leads to improved outcomes. The sooner UX is involved, the better. And what we found in the data was that most organizations, because UX resources like product managers are relatively scarce, tend to front load the UX professionals from the conception through the development phase. And that tells us that they're primarily focused on new products as well as high value initiatives inside the organization. But as you look further downstream, you know, such as incremental improvements to existing products, only about a third of UX professionals are actively involved in that level of activity. So, you know, there's clearly an opportunity here. I mean, they can. There's no question that they could add a lot of value downstream as well on the incremental side, but they're not being used that way. So the sooner that UX is involved, the more likely the team is to actually be high performing as well.
Okay. And that follows a trend I've been seeing for sure is more. There's more people talking about UX's role related to product development this year than I've seen in recent years. And it's something I've long associated with product development, right? Getting that user experience, regardless of the kind of product, whether it's a user interface for a software application or some physical device, you know, how you interact with it. Getting that user experience fine-tuned makes a big difference in the perception of value for customers. So the key outcome of this finding is get your UX people involved early in product teams?
Yeah. A, they need to be on the product team. B, you know, the way organizations are using them is with high value ones. And then C, you know, the more that you can bring them in early in the from ideally the conception phase through the development phase is going to provide dividends for you.
Okay. So these were four new factors that you had not seen in the previous 3 years of studies. And you also share that each year you see new factors from the study, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So the overarching theme here is, you know, what are the factors that directly influence a product team's performance? And what are you up to now for total number of factors?
Well, we're at 19, just shy of 20.
Okay. And you said something early on when we were talking that I thought was really important was that the absence of any of these factors can have you've seen a huge difference. I believe you said it was the best companies do all 19 and those that aren't the best companies. What was the difference there you shared with us?
Yeah, actually a little bit different than the way you just framed it. So mm-hmm. let me clarify.
Thank
so
you.
in our first study in 2012, teams that actually had all five factors in place had a 67% chance of being high performing. In the absence of those factors, only 2% of teams indicated that they were high performing. So it was really eye opening from a statistical analysis standpoint to see that that level of clarity around the difference between what the impact these factors had. And then, you know, I think where just to talk about the 19 factors, what we've since done since then is we've actually then scaled each one of these factors on a 10-point scale. The highest factor is a 7-point. We have nothing in the 8, 9, or 10 scale, but ranging from 1 to 7, each one of those factors then has, some have a higher statistical correlation with performance in terms of their impact. So if an organization says, hey, we're going to focus on 5, do you want to focus on the 1s or do you want to focus on the 6s and 7s that are going to have the greatest impact on performance within your teams? So that's sort of the way that we've gone about doing this. I'm sure that somewhere down the road we'll discover something that breaches the 7 scale, mm-hmm. but that's as high as anything's ranked right now.
Very good. So I would imagine everyday innovators listening are pretty excited about to dive into this more, to think about how they can really help their product teams reach higher levels of performance. So where can we find out the details of your study?
Yeah, if you go to our website, www.actuationconsulting.com, that's actuationconsulting.com. There is a tab on the nav bar that says download the study. And below it, there's also one that says download infographics. We have not only done the study this year, but just like last year, we've created a series of really compelling infographics. If I do say so myself, I don't do any of that work. It's our graphic designer, but I like what she did. But it really boils down, particularly the team performance key points, as well as the UX product management ones, onto two separate sheets that the listeners can download and utilize at their convenience.
Wonderful. And I will put links in the show notes too to make it easy to get to that information. And as I always do, I like to end with a innovation quote. And I asked you to bring one and share it today and why you chose it. What is that?
Okay, well, I've become a huge fan of Elon Musk. I think the guy's the greatest thing since sliced bread as it relates to, the next Steve Jobs, if you will. And so the quote that I selected actually is really rather simple, but I think it's true. And that is, any product that needs a manual to work is broken. And so the reason I'm so impressed with Elon Musk is he sort of writes his own playbook. For example, his thinking on the topic of patents or his new home battery system. Mm-hmm. To me, he is really like the new Steve Jobs, not in personality, but in the way he does not really stand on convention. He's always looking outside the box and thinking of things in, unconventional ways, which, ties directly back to, innovation. If you're not looking for opportunities outside the box, you can't effectively innovate. But regarding the quote, I really agree with him. I think excellent products should meet a core need and be simple and intuitive. And if they're not, then I think there's something wrong. So in my experience, it's always easier to engineer complexity, and simplicity is much harder, mm-hmm. more meaningful and more elegant and ultimately more useful. So I'm all for Elon Musk's quote.
I like it. Absolutely. I think things should be intuitive and easy to use. Well, I want to thank you again for sharing some of the key points from your study of product team performance and letting everyone know how to find that. And can you just share the URL one more time?
Sure. It's www.actuationconsulting.com.
Great. Greg, thank you so much for your time and for doing that study for us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.